From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headley. Should a president inspire patriotism or fear?
That's right. We don't submit to terror. We make the terror.
That is Kevin Spacey as Frank Underwood in Netflix's House of Cards. In a minute, we'll talk with one of the political minds behind that show. First, though, we talked last week about how sports fandom can sometimes become an identity.
People who study sports fans make a big deal about the fact that this is ritualistic behavior. We put on our special clothing. We go to certain sacred space, almost. There are certain chants and cheers that we engage in.
That is Emory philosophy professor Erin Tarver, who wrote about this in her latest book. She describes sports fandom as being similar to religion in today's world. Here are your first thoughts. Dennis from Athens called us and says he does not understand the obsession over sports.
All we do is think about how can my son become a famous football player and become a millionaire? What about astrophysicists? What about chemistry teachers? What about English teachers for that matter? We are way off the rails here and it's destroying our society.
We always love to get your opinion. You can call us like Dennis did at 404-500-9457. We're also on the Twitter and on Facebook. Just remember, we might feature your comments on the show. So maybe you've never been to the White House in fact, but we've all been there in fiction.
You will hand over your delegates and you will serve on in my cabinet. And we will forget that any of this ever happened. Because if you don't, I will never forget.
That's a clip from the Netflix series House of Cards. Kevin Spacey plays a sinister Southern politician who schemes and bullies his way into the Oval Office. That might be a sensationalized idea of what happens in the White House, but just how much of it is based on reality? Hopefully not much. With me now is Jay Carson. He worked as supervising producer and political consultant for House of Cards. He's also a Georgia native and is back in his home state to film another political drama, The Front Runner, starring Hugh Jackman, which follows Democratic Senator Gary Hart's scandalous 1988 presidential campaign. Jay's writing that screenplay. Hello there.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing well, thanks. Let's go to that essential question, which you must get all the time, which is how far away is... Well, let's start with House of Cards, because I guess the, how close it is really depends on whether you're talking about House of Cards or West Wing, right?
Yeah, I mean, there's sort of two ends of the spectrum. When we started House of Cards, it was obviously fantastical.
And, yeah, and meant to be.
Of course, it was supposed to be entertainment. I used to say that... you know, if what was actually happening in Washington was that interesting, we would put 13 hours of C-SPAN on the air and everyone would just watch that.
I've watched C-SPAN.
And we wouldn't have to make a television show. But as we got deeper into the show and in this latest administration, it's I don't know if it's life imitating art or truth being stranger than fiction, but I have no idea what we would do. I mean, my friends still work on the show. I don't anymore, but I have no idea what we would do to go beyond
to
what's actually happening in real life.
We hear the same sort of comments coming out of writers for, say, Scandal and other shows. And even Veep says, how do we turn this into a comedy? Let's actually hear a little clip from Veep, produced by HBO. Here's Selina Meyer, upset about some developments in the election.
Nevada is my state. I'm going to be president. I'm going to be the first elected lady president. I'm going to have a lovely inauguration. Billy Joel is going to sing. So you guys have to stop the recount.
I'm sorry, what?
Stop the count.
Right. Shut up, Gary. Ma'am, we can't.
I don't care.
The train has very publicly left the station and derailed at high speed.
No, yeah, stop the count.
Okay, so...
I love that show.
Now, you, what do you like about it?
It gets to the inanity of the world. Too often in politics, I find that political stories are generally told in a binary way. You're either a hero that saves the world or you're a murderous villain. And that's not how people are in real life, and that's not generally how people are in politics. And what I find great about Veep is that it finds the humor in the world, the ridiculousness of what happens on a day-to-day basis. You know, it misses a little of the earnestness that really does exist in Washington. I say this, and I really mean it, although it may not be true now in this administration, but 99.9% of people that I met when I was in D.C. on both sides of the aisle came to D.C. for the right reasons. Now, they lose their way at some at some point when they're there, at maybe a week after they get there, or 10 years after they get there, most people really are there for the right reasons, at least in the beginning.
Okay, we're going to explore that for just a second. First, let's hear another clip from House of Cards. Here's Frank Underwood doing what he does best.
Now, I'm going to say to you what I say to every congressman that sits where you're sitting now. Vote your district. Vote your conscience. Don't surprise me. And the most important one of those is don't surprise me.
Now, it sounds like you are your political opinion runs to the left of the current Trump administration. That's the hint I'm getting from you.
It does. I mean, I worked in Democratic politics for a long time. I don't know that I find myself at home in either party these days. I really don't. I mean, that's who I worked for a long time. I worked for both the Clintons, you know, as a political staffer for almost 15 years. But yeah, I would say, I guess I'm to the left of the Trump administration. I don't really know where the Trump administration stands on a lot of stuff. So, because, you know, on Monday it's this and Tuesday it's that and Wednesday it's this. I'm definitely to the, yeah.
And he seems to be feuding more with Republican congressmen, politicians at this point than Democrats.
I can't track where he or that administration is. But yes, I'm probably to the left of certainly their extremist views on things.
The reason I ask this is because as a journalist, I am with you. Somebody's political party tells me nothing about what kind of person they are.
Yeah.
And then how do you then, I mean, people are always saying you don't want to go in the back doors, right? Because nobody wants to see the sausage being made. But that's been your job now, is showing that sausage being made to
that's
a certain
true.
Extent. How do you turn that into entertainment?
You know, I mean, look, we did it with House of Cards, and people were wildly entertained, still are, and, you know, have been for many seasons. We took some of the I don't want to say worst, but for lack of a better word, I will. So we took some of the worst instincts of people in Washington and we put them on the screen and we showed the power. We showed power hungry. We showed venality. We showed the drive to succeed. We basically showed someone, I said, most people come for the right reasons and then they lose their way at some point. We showed a man and his wife who had horribly lost their way a long time ago and in what that led to. Their drive to succeed, you know, by any means.
Let's hear then a completely different kind of president. That is Josiah Bartlett of The West Wing, who that's often pointed to as being one of the best political shows ever.
Mr. President, the U.S. is trampling on the sovereignty of my country. And on behalf of President Enzeli,
I've just taken your airport, clearing the way for the 101st Air Assault to take the Capitol. 7,000 troops, 25 battle tanks. 15 Apache attack helicopters and 3 destroyers. Strictly speaking, I conquered your country without the paperwork.
What's the different challenge between writing a Frank Underwood, who's also a Democrat but awful and a murderer, as opposed to
a literal murderer?
That happens pretty immediately, so that's not a spoiler.
Beginning of the second season.
Yeah. So writing somebody who's more heroic.
You know, it's interesting. Those two shows, I think, were just right for their time. I love The West Wing. You're right. It is one of the greatest political shows that have ever been made. And it was perfect for the time. I think that's what people were looking for then. That was the story people were looking to be told.
To believe in government,
to believe in the people that were there, to see an idealistic version of it, but to see it in that great way that Sorkin can do it, where you get some of the behind the scenes and you get to understand the characters. You know, we were telling a different story with House of Cards in a period where people had lost their belief in it and did believe in the cynicism that existed in Washington and sort of did believe in the darkness. And we just took that and put it on steroids and put it on the screen. And people loved it.
And ironically, that was actually about the UK first.
It was. I know. Exactly. We based it on a miniseries that was on
So that cynicism was there in the across the pond.
I mean, the cynicism's been there in Washington. I mean, in politics forever. It's just to what degree it dominates. I think it dominates now more than I have ever seen. But you know, and we're trying to tell a different story. I can't get too much into the movie.
I know you can't give us details about the front runner, but I do have one question, which is, what's the difference of it in terms of challenge between writing something completely fictional, like literally you can choose whatever happens with Frank Underwood, including murdering people, as opposed to writing about a true story in a fictional way?
There's a, you know, it's interesting. There's an upside and downside to both. There's a freedom to writing total fiction where if you want a character to throw someone in front of a subway train, for instance. You can have them do it. You can choose when and where they do it, who's there. You can just literally make it up. It all comes out of your brain. When you're writing a nonfiction story, you have to hew to the facts, and that actually it can be a great thing in that it can require a lot of discipline. If you can make a factual story work and you can really create the drama around it, it can be a very difficult form of writing, but you also can't, as I said, you can't put 13 hours of C-SPAN on the air, and you have to figure out how to combine details and sometimes compress time in a way that that will keep the audience's attention without losing the essential truth and the fundamental truth of the story and the characters.
Has your time and experience in Georgia influenced the way you write about politics, do you think?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I worked for Hillary Clinton in her 08 campaign, and she used to always say, I don't know if she's ever said this publicly, but she used to always say, the best people to hire on your campaigns are Southerners. That we sort of understand politics at an innate level because people say, like, when did you learn to write? And I learned to tell stories growing up in Georgia, because people would sit around and tell stories. And I don't mean that in some, we'd sit on the front porch and tell stories every day, but there was a way that you sort of learned to wind up and pitch a story growing up here. That has been incredibly helpful to me in my writing life. And then, you know, being edited, I wrote a number of speeches for Bill Clinton when I worked for him, and being edited by him, another Southerner, and sort of saying, like, you know, I would remember I'd use a 5-syllable word thinking how smart I'd been in that. And he said, why are you saying that word? Just say good.
And that's not a bad Bill Clinton impression.
Yeah, and he was right. And so I learned to not overwrite from him. And so, yeah, being from the South has had an enormous influence on my writing, I think in a mostly positive way.
So in the 2 minutes that we have left, are you guys the chicken or the egg? In other words, are you helping to drive the cynicism about government? Are you only reflecting what exists?
I love to say we're only reflecting what exists. And I love to come back and talk about the movie, because it really gets into a time where...
Once you can, yeah.
Yeah, when it comes out next year, I'd love to come back and talk about it. It gets into a time of where it changed, where our focus changed and where our values changed in politics. And I think it predicts where we ended up today with a celebrity as a politician. When we treat our politicians like celebrities, we'll end up with a celebrity as a politician. I'd love to say we're just reflecting it. I think probably sometimes we are, we are influencing it. But I don't think, the existence of House of Cards did not make D.C. a dark place. D.C.'s had its darkness from the very beginning. I mean, and people say, oh, politics has gotten awful now. People were caned on the floor of the House and Senate in the late 1800s.
Yeah. Like, Benjamin Franklin was a dog.
Correct. Beaten to a bloody pulp on the floor of the United States Senate. So it's been a dark business. Whenever you have that much power and money, it's going to be. But there have also been times where we listen to our better angels, and we're not in one of those times now, but hopefully we can return to it.
And that's not what House of Cards is anyway, Jay Carson.
That is true.
Political consultant, filmmaker, former producer for Netflix's House of Cards, currently working on The Front Runner. Jay, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Just ahead, we'll talk about why Georgia exports more guns than any other state. First, though, building a hospital in rural Georgia, that can't be a bad thing, right? Well, this is On Second Thought. It's On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. Hospital closures make it harder to get health care in rural Georgia. We've talked about that quite a bit. They also hit the economy pretty hard as well. And yet one South Georgia county's attempt to open a new for-profit hospital is creating controversy. Some say Lee County's plan for a medical center will put neighboring Doherty County's not-for-profit hospital out of business. Andy Miller's been following the story. Of course, he's the editor for Georgia Health News. Hello again.
Good to be here, Celeste.
So we have comments from both sides, and I'd like to take one argument at a time and have you sort of evaluate what it is that we're hearing. Let's first hear from Lee County Commissioner Billy Mathis. He's talking about why he supports building the new medical center just 5 miles away from an already existing hospital.
Because there's no choice here. There's a monopoly in health care. We, for 39 years, had two hospitals in the area. The large hospital bought their competition. Now there is no competition. So we have some of the highest health care costs in the nation.
Is that correct, that Lee County has some of the highest health care costs in the country?
It's absolutely correct in the sense that in the exchange, health insurance exchange that was created by the Affordable Care Act, at one point Southwest Georgia had the second highest premiums in the country. The only one that was ahead of them was a ski resort area in Colorado. So they absolutely high medical costs.
There. Is it tied to this? He calls it a monopoly of this not-for-profit hospital. Is that the cause of the high health care costs?
Well, there are several factors. That's certainly one. You also have a lot of people who have chronic health conditions in that area. And plus, you only had one insurer at the time in that area in the exchange, and that was Blue Cross.
Okay, so let's hear from the other side. This is Monty Vesey, who's president and CEO of the Georgia Alliance of Community Hospitals. And he says his mission is to preserve and protect not-for-profit hospitals for the state.
We are very concerned about any for-profit entity coming in and cherry-picking certificate of need and only taking the paying patients. So if you take the paying patients out of the hospital, then the hospital is no longer viable.
So this is a real problem, actually. Grady suffers from some of these same issues, correct?
That's correct. But every hospital in the state and rest of the country are looking for those privately insured patients. They pay the best in terms of their insurance coverage. So every hospital, including Phoebe Putney, are looking to attract as many of those folks as they can as patients.
But whose problem is that? That the hospitals have to sort of compete for paying patients? Is that a federal issue? Is that a state issue?
Well, under the CON process, Certificate of Need, which is what hospitals need in order to function and give services a particular service or not, it's a state issue and a federal issue. But the folks down there want competition, as the fellow from Lee County talked about, and there hasn't been any since for the last 5 years since Phoebe took over Palmyra Medical Center in Albany.
All right, so let's hear again from Monty Vesey. He's with the Georgia Alliance of Community Hospitals, and he is sort of reiterating what you just said and why he actually wants to attract those kind of patients.
There's no hospital in the state in Southwest Georgia that sees the number of uninsured and Medicaid patients that Phoebe does. So, yes, the paying patient or the insurers are going to pay more to cover the cost of those who cannot afford to pay. That's the only way you can operate today.
Okay, so that's one. Let's hear just one more real quickly from Lee County Commissioner Billy Mathis. And he says empty beds at the current hospital are why he actually supports building a new one only 5 miles away. Here's Billy Mathis.
Many of the folks here choose to go to other areas for their health care. We'd like to have those people stay here.
So what is actually happening here, Andy? Because there are a number of places in rural Georgia where they're not served by a hospital. As an outside observer, it seems odd to choose to build one that close to another hospital as opposed to some of these areas where there really is not a hospital within 10 or 20 miles.
Well, one knock against Phoebe Putney over the recent years is that the fact that federal reports and national reports have rated their quality of care low. I mean, CMS last year had a 5-star rating system for quality of care in hospitals, and Phoebe only got 1 out of 5 stars. It was one of 5 hospitals in the state that just got 1 star out of 5. So that's an issue for Lee County. Monty has a point, and Phoebe has a point, in the sense that they have argued that the state needs to expand its Medicaid program. So a lot of those uninsured patients in that very poor county would have coverage, and that way more money could come into the hospital, in that case, Phoebe Putney.
So this is we've talked about this before in terms of what might change had the state chosen to take the Medicaid expansion that was paid for by the federal government. And you're saying this is one of those things.
Yes, and this is a very poor congressional district, not only compared with other districts in the state, but also the country. And many of those folks would have gotten coverage under Medicaid expansion.
And then there may not have been this controversy.
Well, it would have been ameliorated, and Phoebe would be doing better financially had that happened.
Andy Miller is editor of Georgia Health News. Georgia's Department of Community Health will decide about Lee County's application to open that hospital by November 15th. Andy, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
The Owens Thomas House in Savannah has been awarded $250,000, $250,000, by the National Endowment for the Humanities. That money will be used for renovations and reinterpretations of the Owens Thomas House Museum. The early 19th century home is one of Savannah's oldest landmarks. Joining me now is Dinah Berry, Associate Professor of History at the University of Texas. Dinah has authored and edited a number of books on the subject of slavery in the South, notably Slavery and Freedom in Savannah. Hi there, Dinah.
Hi there.
And also with us is Leslie Harris, Professor of History at Northwestern University. Leslie co-edited Slavery and Freedom in Savannah. Hi, Leslie.
Hello.
So can one of you describe what the Owens Thomas House Museum is? If I walk in as a visitor now, what am I looking at?
It is an historic home that was built by one of the leading architects of the early 19th century, William Jay. It's a beautifully preserved home owned by a number of families, but most well-known as being owned by the Owens family. The Owens family was one of the leading, wealthiest families in the Savannah area. It is a house that represents the antebellum era very well for the wealthy 1%, if you will.
Although it still has existing slave quarters, so the 1% and their unpaid labor.
Exactly. And the ownership of enslaved people was definitely a marker of the wealth of people during that time. And so in the back, the house has the one of the best preserved urban slave quarters that we have in the nation.
Dinah, there have been a lot of attempts to either create art about slavery times that have gone awry. There have been museum exhibits that have been called out for being insensitive and sometimes offensive. How does one contextualize that era in our history without getting it wrong?
I think one is by hiring and working with scholars that do the work that we've done for all these years. There's a number of historians that consult on projects like the Owens Thomas House. And we worked on this project, and we're happy to be involved with it because we could then look at the context of what happened. We can do the research and work with the staff at Telfair Museums to find out the history behind the ownership of the house, the other satellite properties that the Owens family owned. Because, you know, this particular house, the family George Owens, the George Welshman Owens, owned about 8,000 acres of land on rural plantations in seven different counties in Georgia. So just this community and this house only represented part of his wealth. A lot of his wealth came from the rural plantations that were satellite to the Owens Thomas house.
Leslie, can you remember the first time that you walked into this house and walked into those slave quarters?
Absolutely. That was in, I think, the summer of 2007. I had been to Savannah a few times, but had never gone to the Owens Thomas house. I was visiting with a friend, and we went there, and I was struck by the beauty of the house in the front and by the slave quarters. The interesting thing about urban slave quarters is that owners tried to keep them up because they didn't want to be embarrassed in front of their neighbors. And, of course, over the course of many years, the slave quarters had been repurposed a number of times as apartments. But I was still amazed that they existed, and the Owens, the Telfair Museums had tried to bring them back to their original function so that you could get a sense of the space that enslaved people lived in and shared as they worked for these families in the antebellum era.
So what can you tell the Telfair Museum. What can you tell people who might be interacting as guides or as informative people at the museum? What do you tell them to say? What do they avoid?
It's not so much that. It's as with all elements of the house, what historic sites like the Owens Thomas House are trying to do is to present the whole history. And what the NEH grant is enabling the Owens Thomas House to do is to deepen our understanding of, I would almost say, the ecology of the house, the ways that blacks and whites interacted in various spaces in the house. With most historic homes, you walk into the front door, you see all of the fancy beds, you imagine, you know, that you're having dinner at the fancy table. What the Owens Thomas House has been doing for really the last 2 to 3 decades is understanding how those homes were maintained, the labor that it took. And so for the docents and for people visiting to present the enslaved people as laborers in the home, as people who were coerced laborers, and to understand more deeply the relationship between blacks and whites in the system of slavery is very important. The Owens Thomas House, for example, is working on recovering the workspaces that enslaved people labored in. And so that's going to give people a great idea of the kind of hard labor that enslaved people did just about 24 hours a day. Certainly, they slept a few hours, but they were the first up in the morning in a house like the Owens Thomas House and the last to go to bed at night, and they were on call for the wealthy owners. And so it's a matter of presenting the truth. There may be people who are disturbed by hearing some of these details, but in my experience of working with museums on presenting the whole truth of slavery, more people are curious and they want to know more, and they're also excited. They become excited about the history in a different way. We live in a nation where people have hidden this history, and hiding things often makes us we feel uncomfortable as a community when we know that we're not getting the truth. And so,
I want to go in a little further into that, because I want to tell you about an exchange I just had last week in which I was talking to somebody on the plane, and I said, well, you know, the era of slavery lasted in the United States for longer than a century and a half, and the other person said, no. That is not true. And I thought to myself, Dinah, maybe you can address this. Why is our knowledge of that era so inaccurate in general?
Well, part of it is, and I've said this before, it's the way we've taught it in history books, particularly in the K-12 books. It's brushed over, it's overlooked, and people are, as Leslie just said, are uncomfortable with the topic of slavery, and they'll say, oh, it was a long time ago. But it really wasn't that long ago, and we have people that have, you know, 2 or 3 generations removed from slaveholders and from enslaved, enslaved
families.
Yeah,
that's
me. Yeah. A lot of us are connected in their own ways. And it's not, I think it's the stain on our country, our country's history, and because of it, there's a lot of shame and embarrassment and anger that is associated with understanding that we actually were a country that owned human beings. You know, some of our founding fathers owned human beings, and our country has been built and profited off of the institution of slavery. And people are not comfortable with that because it's the great shame of our nation.
Well, then, in the 2 minutes that we have left, Leslie, what do you make of the argument that, look, it's been over a century, and I am a person who I personally didn't own slaves. I didn't, you know, torture people. So why can't we let this go?
Sure. And I want to say one thing about the Owens Thomas House that's important as well. The Owens Thomas House welcomes many schools over the course of the school year on tours. And so they are helping to fill in the gaps in the history of slavery in the K-12 schools. But the other thing I want to say is that we really have to realize that the exploration of the Americas, the economy of the Americas, from the moment that Columbus came, he came with the understanding that he might be planting sugarcane in the Americas, and that is a slave-produced good, even in the Mediterranean, on European and in old Europe. And so enslaved labor underpinned the exploration, founding, and the economy and wealth of the Americas. So there would be no Americas as we know it without large numbers of enslaved people who also composed the majority of immigrants to the Americas before the 19th century. So your friend on the plane who didn't know that slavery had lasted so long, slavery lasted from the moment, started practically from the moment of European exploration of the Americas. And even people who came to the Americas after slavery ended, a lot, you know, people who come in the great European migrations of the 20th century, they were able to be here because slavery was also a global system that underpinned the Industrial Revolution. Without the Industrial Revolution, that would not we would not have the sort of factory labor that contributed to their ability to become workers and then wealthy people. So slavery and slave labor really underpinned our modern economy. And the Owens-Thomas House is one example, a very personal example of, in some ways, of how enslaved blacks and whites lived and worked together. But slavery was really a global system, African slavery in particular.
That is Leslie M. Harris, a professor of history at Northwestern University, and Dinah Berry, associate professor of history at the University of Texas. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thank you.
Just ahead, a Georgia mother whose son was shot and killed talks about how to solve gun violence. First, though, what is the Iron Pipeline? This is On Second Thought. It's On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. Tomorrow, we explore gun violence in Georgia. Our Peach State is a leading exporter of illegal guns. That's largely due to the I-95 corridor. That's where guns flow from Georgia to other parts of the country with laxer firearm restrictions. This route has a nickname. It's the Iron Pipeline. Many of the illegal weapons that end up in New York City started in Georgia. Last year, my colleague Adam Ragusa spoke about the Iron Pipeline with New York City's public advocate, Tish James. She says in spite of its tough gun laws, her city continues to endure a gun violence epidemic.
According to stats from New York City's police department, 90% of the guns recovered were actually purchased in some of our neighboring states that have lax gun restrictions, and they were transported here and they were used in a number of crimes. In fact, not only in New York, but also in New Jersey, two-thirds of the guns that were tied to criminal activity were purchased out of the state in 2014.
Wow. The investigative news show Viceland on Vice TV recently did a documentary where they explored the Iron Pipeline from Atlanta to New York in particular. A former gun runner who goes by the name of Stone Mountain Red explained how he got into the trafficking business. Let's listen.
Being from a small town that had no jobs, that's how I got in the game in the first place. And there was already too many people selling drugs, so I got caught up on weapons. Over the course of a lifetime, I probably had anywhere from 2,000 to 3,000 guns. I really don't have a count. If someone wanted to buy a gun right now, I could give them a gun this evening. Those are the easiest weapons to buy.
So, Tish, we know how the gun dealers get their guns in Georgia. How do they sell them in New York? And is that not a place where you can crack down on the inflow, the illegal gun market in your own city?
Well, you know, it's states like Georgia, Pennsylvania, and South Carolina, and others all along the I-95. According to stats, 50,000 guns were, somehow they ended up in the hands of criminals.
Yeah.
And oftentimes they're sold on our streets. They're sold in back of cars. They're sold in dark alleys. They're sold, in the shadows of New York City. And unfortunately, they're used in a significant number of crimes in New York City, and they get into the hands of gang leaders, which is part and parcel the reason why we are seeing so much gun violence in New York City. I must admit that, you know, there's been, NYPD has done a great job. There's been a decrease in crime in New York City, mm-hmm. but unfortunately, we still see too many young men, particularly young men of color, lose their lives as a result of senseless gun violence.
Certainly. Now, you have some specific policy proposals designed to limit phenomena like the Iron Pipeline. What are they?
It's going to take a multi-state task force in order to address this Iron Pipeline. And so what we are attempting to do is work with our mayor, Mayor de Blasio, and other mayors in the city of New York to address this issue, as well as governors. Governor Cuomo has been in the forefront of this issue, and we're looking forward to working with him and other governors and other municipalities who cover the I-95 to address this problem. It includes, but is not limited to, background checks. It includes, but is not limited, making sure that we close loopholes. As a member who sits on the pension board for New York City, we have 7 pension boards as part of NYSERS, the New York City Retirement Security System. I passed a resolution recently, which basically calls for the divestment of public pension dollars in gun manufacturers and gun retailers all across this country. We had a protest recently against TD Bank because TD Bank issued a loan to a gun manufacturer, and we are calling for them to rescind that and or for New York City to stop doing business with TD Bank. We also led a rally recently with Gays Against Gun Violence, who focused on a fitness outlet, where they were giving away Glocks as prizes for individuals who were competing in a competition. And we are also, again, urging that we track guns, that we map guns, that we begin to focus on smart guns, smart technology. I was in the forefront of body cameras in New York City. We need to ban assault weapons in this country, and we need to make sure that this is a signature issue in national elections in this country.
We're talking about the flow of illegal guns purchased legally, oftentimes in Georgia, states like Georgia, in the south, across the southeast, states with lighter gun laws, and then being moved and sold illegally in states with stricter gun laws, places like New York City. On the line with us is Tish James, who is the public advocate for New York City. Here to tell us more about the Iron Pipeline is BuzzFeed News national editor Tina Sussman. She has reported extensively on this issue for the LA Times. Tina, how do the originators of the pipeline, the people who smuggle the guns up north, how do they buy them in places like Georgia? Is it as simple as they just go to the Bass Pro Shop and fill up their shopping cart?
Well, there's a lot of different ways of getting guns in Georgia, and that, of course, is the root of the problem as they see it here in New York. The gun laws in Georgia make it very, very simple, relatively speaking, to get a gun. Now, a lot of these guns are sold perfectly legally in Georgia by various gun dealers. Others are stolen, I believe Georgia is one of the states where you are not required by law to report a gun that's been stolen. Mm-hmm. And you can also buy guns on the Internet. It's a very easy thing. There's various online sites that sell guns. A lot of dealers are perfectly legitimate, but there's an awful lot that will – a lot of individuals are happy to sell guns to anyone that has enough money to buy the guns that they're trying to get rid of. So there's countless ways for dealers to get these guns, which they then transport up the highway.
We talked last year to Daniel Webster. He's the director of the Nonpartisan Center for Gun Policy and Research. It's based out of Johns Hopkins. He says that all sorts of people contribute to this flow of guns from the south to the north, ranging from people who do it in bulk as a major professional criminal exercise, also just people who do it a little bit less frequently. Let's listen.
Sometimes you have girlfriends or family members who are convinced to get the gun, buy the guns for the criminals. Sometimes it's people simply saying, hey, I can make a few bucks. I'm going to college in Georgia. I got family in New York. I know how much I can make on each trip I go back home.
So Tish James, New York City public advocate, I mean, what policies could be explored that would get at something as in small scale and informal as what we just heard described?
Well, it's important to know that Georgia in 2014 passed this law called Guns Everywhere.
And informally called that, yeah.
Yeah, guns, Georgia has no criminal penalties for straw purchasers, people who buy firearms for those who are banned from doing so themselves. They don't require background checks for people purchasing guns from unlicensed dealers, including at gun shows and online. And they don't require gun owners to file a police report, as Tina just mentioned, if their guns are lost or stolen. We could focus on though on reversing that law, which is, as you indicated, informally referred to as guns everywhere. We really need to make sure that this is a multi-state task force. But most important, I think, during these national elections, we need to make sure that passing responsible gun laws in this country is a priority for this political season.
Let's hear from a gun rights advocate. We spoke with Jerry Henry. He's the executive director of Georgia Carry, and he says that it's actually New York City's restrictive gun laws that are the entire problem behind this iron pipeline. Let's listen.
The only reason these guns are being traced, trafficked anywhere is because there's a market for it. And the market in New York City has been created by the strict laws within the city. Gun control doesn't work.
Tina Sussman of BuzzFeed News, I suppose the first part of that assertion is unassailable, right? I mean, there would be no flow of guns from the south to the north if places like New York City allowed guns to be sold more freely, right?
Well, correct. There is, I mean, it is a basic issue of supply and demand. You know, the supply is in Georgia. There is a demand up here because of the vastly different laws. And so you can look at it that way. But on the flip side, the advocates of stricter gun laws will say, well, that's why you need more federal control over this, because when you have 50 different states, each with incredibly different laws governing gun ownership and gun transport, you end up with this kind of weird supply and demand system. And it's important, I think, to note also that this is not just an issue between Georgia and New York. I mean, one of the most striking illustrations of the impact of these vastly different laws state to state is in Illinois versus neighboring Indiana. Chicago has a very high gun violence problem, and opponents of gun control laws will say, well, you know, Illinois has strict gun control laws and Chicago has terrible gun violence, therefore the laws don't work.
That's BuzzFeed News national editor Tina Sussman speaking with my colleague Adam Ragusea. We also heard from New York City public advocate Tish James. Georgia is no stranger to the tragedy of gun violence. On November 23, 2012, Atlanta native Jordan Davis was shot and killed at a Jacksonville, Florida gas station. The African-American teen was unarmed when a white man named Michael Dunn shot him. Dunn was reportedly angered by the music Davis and his friends were playing in their car. Michael Dunn drew a life sentence for that murder. Here's Dunn speaking about the case during a phone call after his arrest.
Everything is absurd. It's like, I'm the victim here. It's 100% on Jordan. 100%. I don't even take a 0.5%. I mean, he made that happen. But, you know, maybe he would have killed somebody if it hadn't been me.
That audio is courtesy of the HBO documentary 3.5 Minutes, 10 Bullets. In 2015, I spoke to Jordan's mom, Lucia McBath, who was in the courtroom during the trial. I wonder what that was like for you, Lucy, to hear Michael Dunn saying these things. I mean, at one point, he says he might have saved someone else's life by killing your son. What was that like to listen to that?
Well, I mean, very early on, we knew that a lot of what we were dealing with was racism. But we kept that quiet. We didn't feel the need to point that finger and so-called play the race card at that moment, even though we knew that Michael Dunn was racist and pretty much could not have done what he did, not unless he had inhibited those feelings. But to actually hear it on audio and to actually see it written in the letters, the jailhouse letters, was just, it was horrible. It was horrible because it was all spelled out for us. Here, you know, our boy and the boys had come in contact with just somebody that had such horrible thoughts and ideas about, you know, people of color, about, you know, young black men. And I think it was just really so troublesome to us because we know that there are a lot of Michael Dunns walking around in the country.
Who don't think that they're racist.
Who don't think that they're racist. And that's so disheartening because, you know, we say how far we've come in this country, and we're supposed to be a post-racial society, but it appears to us as we see what's happening in the country most recently, you know, there is a resurgence again of racism. And the thing that I find is that it's been there all along. This undercurrent of this kind of racism that we see now has been here all along. And now people seem far more relevant to wear it as a chip on their shoulder.
Lucy, let's hope that no other parent has to go through what you have gone through to kind of understand some of the issues of the day. I mean, everybody talks and debates about stand your ground. Everyone talks and debates about gun control and talks and debates about racism. Mm-hmm. But would none of us ever think we're going to lose our kid to these philosophical ideas? So what would you say is sort of the message of your son's death? What do you say to other parents who may still feel very disconnected from these topics?
I say to them is that I believe that what we're seeing in the country right now is kind of an awakening of the larger problems that we're dealing with, conflicts. And I think the crises that we see with, you know, all the young men that are dying in the country, and then, you know, the children at Sandy Hook and all of these that we could list, all these kinds of shootings are happening. I think it's just systemic of something that's even bigger and broader in the country that has to be dealt with. And so what I try to say to those parents that, you know, many of them, a lot of them, you know, their cases are never in the public. A lot of them have never received any justice for the murder of their loved ones. And what I try to say to them is that I think this is an awakening in the country that is going to cause us as a nation, us individually, collectively, to look at just who we are and what we think about our fellow man. And how much value do you place on the lives of people that don't look, think, or act like you? And how much value do you place on communities that are outside your own focus and realm? And if you have not committed yourself to thinking about others and the plight of others in this country, then basically shame on you. Shame on you, because if you believe that what is happening in the country cannot or will not happen to you, you're sorely misguided, because the violence, gun violence now has, and the implicit biases and everything have all gone way beyond the ghetto and way beyond the urban area. And so now no one is immune to these kinds of conflicts and opinions and issues that we're dealing with.
That's Lucia McBath of Atlanta. Her teenage son, Jordan Davis, was killed in 2012 following a confrontation over loud music. And that's our show for today, but we really want to hear from you, because tomorrow we have a special hour of programming. We dedicate the entire show to examining gun violence in Georgia. And we really want to know what you think. Do you own a gun? Do you think we should have tighter controls on guns? Tell us why or why not. Call us at 404-500-9457 or reach us on Twitter. For today, that's On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Celeste Headlee. Have a great day.